want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. I want to thank Mark Brodsky outside Chicago and Susan Fellows somewhere in America. They're sponsoring today's podcast.
Summer has come and passed. The innocent can never last. Wake me up when September ends.
Our music of the moment from the Bay Area is Green Day.
Like my father.
And this American Idiot song collection is now a rock opera. I haven't seen it yet, but I want to check it out.
Wake me up when September ends.
As our pronouncer said, this program is supported by listeners. I appreciate your help in covering the cost of launching this podcast. And if you'd like to help, just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. And you can subscribe on a voluntary basis for as little as $5 a month. And every supporter helps, so do what you can. Coming up shortly in this podcast, we're going to talk with filmmaker Joe Berlinger. His powerful new documentary, which is not one-sided, is about the now 17-year-long legal battle between Chevron Texaco and the indigenous tribes of Ecuador in the Amazon Basin. And this is the legacy of Chevron's merger with Texaco. Texaco just raped the landscape there in Ecuador in search of oil for us. And it is apparently a $27 billion liability to Chevron. And it's quite a story. And lately there have been some antics where a couple of provocateurs on Chevron's side bought some of those little spy cameras that look like a Sharpie pen. And tried to entrap the judge in this case into making some intemperate remarks. And now Chevron is saying, oh, he's biased, and they want to throw the case out. After they moved the case to Ecuador, where they thought they could get a better deal. So we'll hear the details on that from Joe Berlinger coming up in just a few minutes here on the Peter B. Collins Show. But first, I want to talk about Afghanistan. And two great people who've been on our program before join us today. Con Hallinan writes for Foreign Policy in Focus. He's also a columnist at the Berkeley Daily Planet. He ran the journalism program at University of California, Santa Cruz for 23 years, and he retired back in 2004 to concentrate on writing for Foreign Policy. And he was awarded the Project Censored Award in 2007 for investigative journalism. Con, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also Reese Ehrlich, an independent journalist whose work has appeared in many publications and also on radio for NPR and networks around the world. He has been on our program to talk about Iraq. He co-authored a book called Target Iraq with our friend Norman Solomon. And he also wrote The Iran Agenda, The Real Story. And his most recent book, which we also discussed on a previous program, Dateline Havana, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Future of Cuba. Reese, welcome back to the show.
Real pleasure to be here.
So let me start with you, Reese, because you recently traveled to Afghanistan, unembedded, with Norman Solomon, who we just referenced. Take a minute or two and tell us what you saw.
Well, I had a chance to travel both within Kabul and out into the countryside towards the Pakistan border, and did a couple of very interesting stories. I think your listeners are well aware of the serious heroin problem in Afghanistan. It provides about 90% of the world's heroin. What they may be less aware of is that the people who control the heroin trade are not the Taliban and insurgents. I think that's the general impression that the U.S. has always wanted to leave. According to UN figures, and I met with the head of the UN drug operation in Kabul, only 3% of the heroin trade in Afghanistan is controlled by the insurgents. Again, 3%. So who controls the other 97%?
That's Karzai's brother, right?
He's right up there. Exactly. It's the ordinary criminals in a criminal underworld, plus warlords loyal to the United States. Karzai's brother, the current former defense minister who's now the vice president of the country, various cabinet members, various Karzai and U.S. allies. And basically that's been going on from the beginning. The folks who were fighting the Taliban back in the 90s financed their war with heroin. And when the U.S. allied with them to defeat the Taliban in 2001, they simply moved their operations to Kabul, and they've been running a drug operation ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So it's total hypocrisy on the part of the United States to decry this horrible scourge of drugs while, in fact, allying itself with the people who are maintaining it.
Now, you were also there as the count was underway in this obviously fraudulent election. Karzai appears to be modeling after George W. Bush.
Yeah, it makes Florida look honest.
What was the reaction? Is the public kind of passive about this?
No, people are angry, but you have to understand, even before the elections took place, there was widespread fraud in terms of voter registration and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And most Afghans that I spoke to said, these elections are not being held for the people of Afghanistan, they're being held for the sake of public opinion in Europe and the United States.
Yeah,
the U.S. It was a predetermined outcome, even before the votes were cast, that some pro-U.S. candidate would win. The U.S. wanted a guy named Ghazi to win. He's a former World Bank official and so on. The only problem was he had no popular support.
Mm-hmm.
He came in fourth, actually, in the election. So given the choice of several bad people that the U.S. was not terribly fond of, but are certainly working to, willing to work with, Karzai being the top one, they're basically going to ratify Karzai's election, even though there was massive fraud. Probably they should just toss out everything and start all over again. But the people of Afghanistan have a much better understanding of the role of the elections than people here do.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't surprised by it. People probably would go out into the streets if that didn't mean getting shot. People are angry at the results, but
mm-hmm.
there's not a whole lot they can do. It's not like Iran, ironically, where people could go out in the streets and protest.
Con Hallinan, your comment on the election and the second place guy, Abdullah, is no human rights advocate. He's a guy with a lot of blood on his hands.
Oh yeah, and he's closely tied into the Northern Alliance, and the Northern Alliance is in some ways the core of the sort of warlord government that took over after the American invasion, and what Reese is saying is absolutely correct. I mean, this was theater. I mean, what the election was theater, and it was theater for the American public. It was theater, particularly for NATO, because NATO is running into terrible problems at home. They've really lost the home front. There isn't a country in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that actually supports sending troops there. And a number of important allies, Canada, the Netherlands, are withdrawing troops and will be out by 2011. And so this election was seen as a way to say, well, see, look, we're having democracy, and that's what we're doing. The war is not over. The war is really a reconstruction war, and it's over building schools and digging wells. And the election is a sign of that. And, of course, you know, the whole thing fell apart because the election doesn't have anything to do with what the actually average Afghani wanted. And so, you know, it's turned in from this kind of theater, and it's just gotten really bad reviews. This is one of those theater productions that closes after the first night.
And Reese, the theater continues because we now see President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton using this election as a reason to kind of delay any further decisions. And the president is, I was pleased to hear, he's saying he's skeptical now about putting more troops in there. But my question is more about the fundamental presence of any American troops there, and that this is a lose-lose-lose proposition. Is this benchmark about the election, with the Secretary of State saying, well, gosh, we got to find out who won before we can move forward with any deals with the Afghan government.
Yeah, I think the elections have complicated a situation that existed even had there no elections taken place. The U.S. is losing the war. The allies, NATO allies, have figured that out. And so now, as in the case of all losing wars, we saw a similar debate around Iraq. Well, what do you do? So the military solution always is send more troops. And I was there in 2004 when the U.S. troop count was 19,000, and they had just finished a surge then, and that was supposed to take care of things. And now we're up to, or will be shortly, up to 68,000, and they're saying that's not enough. So the military and the right-wingers and the neocons, all of whom have significant influence in the Obama administration, are going to always call for more troops. And the danger, of course, is that the wimpy liberals are going to say, if we deny more troops, then we're going to be the ones scapegoated for having lost the war. And nobody, of course, wants to lose Afghanistan, although it's never been the United States to lose in the first place. Yeah, it was a terrific, horrific mistake to invade Afghanistan in the first place. What's happening now was entirely predictable. I said it. Lots of other anti-war critics said it at the time. But nobody, of course, in the administration wanted to hear that back then. And the Obama administration, no, to my knowledge, nobody high up in the administration is talking about withdrawing the troops. What they're talking about is whether to send more troops or to simply maintain the 68,000 that they've got now. And the debate has got to start about how to set a timetable for extremely rapid withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Afghanistan. And the people in Afghanistan, by the way, are fed up with the war, too. They're fed up with the fact that the U.S. bombing raids continue to kill civilians despite supposedly changed rules, et cetera.
Yeah, the polls show that 75% Canadians did a poll and found that 75% of the Afghanis want negotiations. 54% are even willing to put up with a coalition government, although the Taliban is not a widely popular organization, even in the South, which is where its traditional base is. And the thing that makes me so crazy about this is it's not like this is rocket science. I mean, back in last October, the Saudi Arabians brought to the United States a 7-point peace proposal by the Taliban. It's not an unreasonable peace proposal. It even backed away from the demand that there be withdrawal of all foreign troops before negotiations. What it called for was setting a 18-month timetable. The rest of the proposals are really not unreasonable. Constitutional convention, new elections, integrating all of the various forces, and the Taliban is only really one of the three insurgent forces.
That's very important to note. Please
right.
go on.
Mm-hmm. Integrating them into, Afghan National Army, et cetera. I mean, there are things which, I'm sure the United States, there are some things the United States doesn't agree with. There has been no coverage of this. There was one piece on the front page of the New York Times about 4 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only mention of this peace plan. So, the idea that we don't know what to do, well, we do know what to do, we're just not willing to do it.
Well, I'll just reference, too, that you wrote about this in one of your columns at FPIF.org. That's the Foreign Policy in Focus website. And I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to. I think that, most Americans have no concept. There's very little media coverage of the conflict in Afghanistan. And, what you just pointed out two things that are lost on most Americans. One is that the Taliban is not a monolithic opposition force, that there is a range of opposition to the Karzai government and to the U.S./NATO occupation. And number two, that there have been overtures from the other side. But we're in a lockdown mode where Mullah Omar and the Taliban have been demonized. And, perhaps Obama will change. He's sending some signals of reconsideration. But to date, he has embraced the stance of the Bush administration and simply added more American troops without redefining the mission and without designating any kind of exit strategy.
Well, what's an interesting read is to have your listeners Google the recent statement by Mullah Omar. And I Apparently, the Taliban has a website with an English translation. They're pretty sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And so
is that Taliban.com?
It's called Shambhala. I'm blanking on the exact thing mm-hmm. of it. If you Google it, there's a piece from Scotland that has the website. And so I got the website off of that, and I went to the website and downloaded the statement and read it through. And if the White House is reading that statement, that there a cold chill ought to go up their spine, because there's a minimal amount of religion and Islam in there, and a maximal amount of national alliances, get rid of your differences, this is the struggle to reclaim Afghanistan from, you know, the invaders and everything. So suddenly what's happening is that struggle in Afghanistan is morphing into a kind of a national liberation struggle. No occupier has ever won that battle
Indeed.
In Afghanistan, and we certainly are not going to do it.
Reese, did you hear any discussion of the Taliban peace plan while you were in Afghanistan, or the people you've talked to since?
Yes. The key thing to understand is that the U.S. vilifies and demonizes everybody in Afghanistan opposes the U.S. as the Taliban. In fact, in addition to Mullah Omar and the old Taliban leaders, you have Hekmatyar, who was actually a pro-U.S. ally, who's also fighting the U.S. right now, and Haqqani, who is also an old U.S. ally, who is now currently fighting the U.S., plus a lot of local warlords, for example, a guy in Herat and a number of other people who have switched sides.
Mm-hmm.
And so they share a common, I mean, it is dangerous in the sense that they share a common fundamentalist misinterpretation of Islam that says they should be in power and women should be oppressed and all of the other things that we've come to associate with that kind of right-wing interpretation of Islam.
They are also unified primarily in opposition to the occupation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the nationalism that Khan was talking about. They are portraying themselves as a national liberation war, that the once the occupiers are out, the people of Afghanistan can decide their own future, et cetera. And that's actually quite appealing, and understandably, because that ultimately is what's going to have to happen. There is this peace and reconciliation process. I met with leaders of it when I was in Kabul. I met with a couple of high-ranking former Taliban people, and they're pretty pessimistic. Well, they're not real optimistic at the moment because Karzai is making no serious efforts towards those kind of peace talks, and the insurgents are on the offensive, so they're not about to start making concessions at the moment. They feel that they're militarily and politically on the upswing. They managed to attack the ISAF headquarters, which is the military headquarters inside this incredibly secure area that's the equivalent of the Green Zone. They carried out 600 attacks on Election Day. I mean, the U.S. is definitely on the defensive militarily, and so the insurgents think they've got the war to win and are not looking towards kind of political compromise at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may change.
Khan, what do you make of the leaked McChrystal report and the expectation that he's going to ask for more troops and that President Obama, unlike Bush, is not going to respond necessarily affirmatively to his hand-picked general in the field?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that the reaction of the Obama administration is, you know, I think that this is a little case of sticker shock, because when Obama first proposed sending, you know, to send the 21,000, surge the 21,000 troops into Afghanistan, they're in the process of arriving there now, you know, he bought into this counterinsurgency proposals, Petraeus' stuff and McChrystal's stuff and everything. And then, you know, I think what happened was that somebody in the White House sat down and they read the manual for counterinsurgency that Petraeus is a partial author of. And it's very formulaic, and one of the formulas is that you have to have 20 soldiers, trained soldiers, 20 soldiers for every 1,000 inhabitants. We got 33 million inhabitants in Afghanistan. You're talking about an army of 660,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, someone in the White House finally looked at that and said, no, you know, we're not going to get there. And by the way, that 660,000, that only gives you the possibility of winning a counterinsurgency war. My own feeling is you could put all the troops in the world into Afghanistan, you still wouldn't win it. But it would just give you a possibility, and it would call for at least 5 to 10 years of occupation, trillions of dollars. And I think what happened was that the Obama administration did a couple of things. One, they looked at what the logic of where counterinsurgency was going to. Two, they looked at the cost. And three, they're looking over their shoulder at the polls in the United States.
Yes, the political base is deserting Obama.
Not there.
On this.
Yeah. Two-thirds of the Obama supporters, two-thirds of them, are opposed to the war in any form whatsoever. And still a majority of the population, even with the Republicans counted in, a majority of the population is very doubtful about this war. So I think that the rethought is a combination of sort of all of those things. And Reese is completely correct. We're losing the war right now. And one of the things that's happened is that we've surged all these Marines into Helmand province. And, of course, what's happened is that the Taliban picked up and moved to the north and to the west. I mean, we should have figured that they were going to do that. That's what guerrilla forces always do. You know, when the enemy is strong, you disperse. When the enemy is weak, you concentrate. And I think maybe people in the White House are beginning to realize exactly what they're getting into. I do want to send them... I'd like to send them something like Kim, for instance, you know, good novel that would maybe indicate why it's not a good idea to get yourself involved in a war in Afghanistan. I don't know. Maybe they're really having an attack of intelligence and sensibility.
Mm. Reese, your comment on McChrystal and the response to him?
Yeah, I think my reading of it is that it was a leak to pressure the Obama administration to send him more troops, to set it up so that if something goes wrong in Afghanistan, it was the wimpy liberals who copped out and who didn't deliver the goods militarily, and they were warned ahead of time, after all. And that's the line that comes out of Fox News and the Wall Street Journal and the right wing. I think it's a foolhardy process, as what Khan said. You can't win the war militarily. You have to start thinking about pulling the troops out rapidly and reaching a political settlement.
Now, one of the things that I'm bracing for is an argument probably coming from the right, but I wouldn't dismiss it coming from so-called progressives, that we can't leave, that we can't abandon the people of Afghanistan. They'll make a human rights case. They'll say the Taliban will repress women in a pattern that we saw in the 1990s. And on the other hand, I think more powerfully, we are creating an ongoing humanitarian crisis ourselves. We continue to, McChrystal has managed to reduce the number of civilian casualties, particularly from drones and airstrikes, but there are, monthly, if not weekly, episodes that cause civilians in Afghanistan to look to local people for protection because they can't trust the occupying force. And then we have the use, the unilateral use, unlimited use of drones on the Afghan-Pakistan border and with incursions into Pakistan on a regular basis. We've gotten almost numbed by the daily reports of these attacks. And so I think it's incoherent to try to make a case for human rights, yet I expect that to be the next wave of arguments as to why we must continue to keep troops there and possibly add more. Reese, you first?
Sure. I think that we're hearing that argument already, and it has some appeal because there's an element of truth in it, which is that if the Taliban forces come back, it is going to be, they may well impose a right-wing interpretation of Islam as we saw in the 90s. The problem is, it's not like Karzai is all that much different. The choice is not between liberal democracy in which women are, women's rights are advancing and unions are legal, et cetera, and versus this evil fundamentalist. As one journalist explained it to me in Afghanistan, what you see are two sets of right-wing fundamentalist Islamist forces, one of which has support of the international community. When you scratch the surface of Karzai and his, particularly his warlord supporters, they're not all that different ideologically from the Taliban. Women's rights have gone backwards in the last few years. You see some advances in Kabul, and that's about it. The women cannot attend the University of Kandahar, for example, just as a small example. And Karzai has no interest in advancing women's rights. So the choice is between two different sets of Islamic fundamentalists, and the only question is how many Afghan civilians and how many American soldiers are going to die before those folks end up reaching a political compromise anyway with the U.S. troops withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to Iraq. In Iraq, there was this myth about a surge and that's winning the war for the U.S., and that's becoming, it wasn't true at the time, it's becoming quite obvious now that that's not the case. And what's going to happen in Iraq when the U.S. troops pull out? You're going to have some kind of a regime there that is an authoritarian regime, if you're lucky, that's anti-U.S. So, you know, the U.S., when it engages in this kind of aggressive war and wars of occupation, it's going to lose and often leaves the situation much worse than before it ever started.
And it was a year ago in one of the debates where Obama yielded to McCain on the myth of the surge. And we're seeing the payback on that.
Yeah, it was baloney. It was baloney at the beginning. It's baloney
absolutely.
Now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Khan, your comment on the human rights card?
Well, I mean, Reese is correct. I've heard it already. In fact, I wrote a piece on Afghanistan, and this a Canadian group who calls themselves lefties and took off after me on the Foreign Policy in Focus website, and I had a sort of debate with them, and their whole line was, you know, look, this is for women. This is all about women's rights. Well, actually, if you ask women in Afghanistan today whether they want the Americans out, the answer would be yes, they do. I mean, the one organization, the League of Revolutionary Afghan Women, has been quite explicit on this, and partly because the warlords are back in power. That's how Karzai runs things. And if the Tufts University recently did a very interesting study where they interviewed 400 Afghanis nationwide, and they asked them what were the issues before them. You know, what were they worried about? Were they worried about security? Were they worried about the Taliban? The single issue that came out on top there was corruption. And the Karzai government runs on corruption. I mean, it's a patronage organization. So the whole idea that we're doing this for women is such nonsense. On top of which, if you look at the civilian casualties, one of the things you notice with civilian casualties, this was also true in Iraq too, is that there's a very high proportion of women and children in those casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is you send small units in. They get ambushed in a town. They call in airstrikes to back them up. And what gets bombed? What gets bombed is houses. Who are in the houses? Women and children. So, you know, from the point of view of the Afghans, if you had a vote right now, what do you want the Americans to do? Overwhelmingly, the Afghans would vote for the Americans and NATO to go. And poll after poll shows that. So shouldn't we leave this up to the Afghans as opposed to us determining what it is we think?
I'm sorry, you don't have the idea of democracy right, Khan.
I struggle on that.
It's a franchise thing.
Right.
That's right. You buy the U.S. version, which is that you hold elections once and you're an emerging democracy.
Yeah.
Let me just make one other, something I did learn from this trip to Afghanistan, that as the anti-war movement gains strength and urges and probably ultimately succeeds in getting troops withdrawn, the U.S. and the people of the United States should not abandon the people of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
People-to-people aid should continue now and even after whatever political settlement is reached. There's tremendous problems caused by the United States in terms of disruption of the infrastructure and the upturning of the society, et cetera. And there are NGOs there doing good work with education and women and others, and they don't want to be abandoned in this process of too often when the U.S. pulls its troops out, then the country's forgotten about, all the aid stops, etc. They don't want to see that happen. There were groups, there were NGOs there working, doing good work even under the Taliban. They're continuing now, and they plan to stay there long term.
Well, and your colleague Norman Solomon was on a previous podcast and made the case that the recent supplemental that was passed by the Congress provided, I believe, 90% military, only 10% humanitarian and diplomatic aid, and those numbers really should be reversed. And Obama has articulated all these things, so it's even more frustrating. because he's on the record acknowledging the history that outsiders have never prevailed in Afghanistan. He acknowledges many of the plaints and complaints that we have raised, yet he continues with a policy that is clearly headed in the wrong direction, and now he seems to be publicly rethinking that. I don't know how much of that is just for effect and how much of it is to mollify the base.
Well, he needs pressure from below on this like he does on every other issue. You see the same thing with health care and all the unnecessary compromises on that. I expect to see something like that on the war in Iraq. I think they're going to try and renege on the withdrawal. The U.S. is committed to withdrawing every one of its troops from Iraq, and at some point we're going to hear, oh, no, we have to leave people, we have to leave 50,000 troops to as trainers or some baloney like that, and we're seeing it on Afghanistan. President Obama was a moderate to begin with. He was not a progressive. He needs pressure from below, just as we had to pressure Bush.
Mm-hmm. Con, in closing here, I just wanted to direct people again to Foreign Policy and Focus, because you have been employing the metaphor of the Rubik's Cube for a few months now to describe the complex situation in Afghanistan and how there may be only one formula or one combination that could really crack this. Explain that a little bit and where you think the Rubik's Cube is set right now.
Well, it's hard to say. I think the Rubik's Cube is very confused right now. There's colors all over the place. And the reason I use that is because I wanted people to understand how complex Afghanistan was, both internally and then regionally and even internationally. And in order to really get a resolution there, you've got to make all of those pieces sort of come together. And you've got the internal situation within Afghanistan and the parties that are fighting one another. You've got tremendous problems of development. This is a country with the number one infant mortality rate in the world. It's a country in which for every one person that dies in the war, 20 people die of treatable diseases and malnutrition. I mean, you just have a terrible situation. But it's also related to not only to Pakistan, but Pakistan and India. One of the reasons why Pakistan is concerned about Afghanistan is because they're concerned about India. Tension is rising between India and Pakistan over Afghanistan. There's a situation with Iran. So I use the issue of the Rubik's Cube to give people an idea that this is really complex stuff, and this idea that you're going to somehow solve the Rubik's Cube by dropping a bomb on it is completely nuts. So I do think that there are some interesting straws in the wind. I'd like to see people go back to this peace proposal. I also agree with Reese at this point that it's very up in the air because the Taliban is on a roll at this point. It's not clear what the administration is doing. And if they make the wrong choice on this one, it's going to more than create a train wreck in Afghanistan. It's going to create a regional train wreck. And for that matter, I think it's going to derail a lot of social welfare programs, here in the United States. I did want to say one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to give you the spelling. I got the website.
Oh, great.
That I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's SHAH, like Shah, AMAT, so one word,
Shahamat.org.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And then there's a little thing that says English. You punch on the English and there you go.
All right. And the NSA will follow us there, right?
Yeah. You bet.
And, Reese, one element that we haven't touched on here is American corporate interests related to Afghanistan. Is that the element that really is underpinning much of this that we don't talk about?
Well, I think I get this question a lot, which is exactly why is the U.S. in Afghanistan again? And since it's not for promoting freedom and democracy or stopping terrorism, what's the real reason? Well, I think the core of it is that Afghanistan has a strategic location.
It right.
neighbors Iran, it neighbors Pakistan, and what goes on there. And, of course, the U.S. has now built it up to a situation where if you, quote, lose, unquote, then, oh, my God, it's going to set back the U.S. Empire throughout the world and blah, blah, blah. I don't think, Afghanistan does not have a lot of resources, although while I was there I found out they do have some mineral resources that, should the war ever end, that could make the place some valuable real estate. But I don't think that's at the core of it. Now, once the war started, there's lots of corporations very happy to take advantage of the situation for profit. And, of course, we know the military companies that do that. But I'm doing a story about big-time aid contractors who are ripping off profits and fraud and waste at an incredible rate. Found out that perhaps 10 or 20% of the money allocated in Washington for economic and other kinds of civilian aid ever actually reaches the people it's intended to help. And the rest is just waste or fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of companies, American companies, making billions of dollars off this war and very happy to do so.
I would add one thing in there, too, and that is that there is a push among some of the NATO allies to turn NATO into a kind of a worldwide military alliance. James Jones, who used to be General James Jones when he headed up NATO and is now the National Security Advisor for the Obama administration, he has called for the use of NATO to do things like ensure oil and gas deliveries from the Gulf of Guinea in West Africa. And he's talked about using NATO in the Pacific Basin, et cetera. I think that people are worried that NATO is going to take a defeat in this war, and that if it does, people back home are going to start saying, so how come we have this alliance still 60 years after it was formed? Warsaw Pact is no longer there. Mm-hmm. Russia's not going to invade Europe. We have this alliance. Why? So I think that there's a great deal of fear that NATO will take a defeat here, and that will derail a lot of these kind of this push to make NATO into a much more kind of global alliance. So there are a lot of issues in the fire, and I agree strongly agree with Reese that, you know, there's a reason why people invade Afghanistan, because it is the crossroads mm-hmm. to India, Pakistan, China, Iran, the Caspian oil and gas resources, you know, China, etc. You know, it's not that it's rich itself. It's just that you got to cross it in order to get to those areas. So strategically, it's enormously important.
Gentlemen, thank you for a great discussion. Con Hallinan, Reese Ehrlich, we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you for having us, Peter.
My pleasure. The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. You'll see that rotating banner ad. You just click on that, and it'll link you up to a special introductory offer for Peter B. Collins listeners. We get a small commission if you buy from the Organic Wine Company. This portion of the program, we're going to talk about oil. We're going to talk about indigenous people and rapacious American corporations.
And the desert oak, holding wrecks and
our music of the moment from Australia's Midnight Oil. It's a song about their native Aborigines and the idea that they ought to give it back. Now, I think we ought to give the Amazon Basin back to the Ecuadorian people in the condition that Texaco found it when they started extracting oil from there decades ago. Joe Berlinger joins us today. He has a powerful new film out called Crude, The Real Price of Oil. This is not agitprop. This is a documentary that does, I think, show both sides of a complex and long-running controversy in Ecuador, where Texaco went in, as I said, decades ago, and then Texaco was sold to Chevron. And Chevron is now trying to avoid liability and what I think is their deep responsibility for the mess that Texaco left behind. Joe, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hey, thanks a lot.
There's a lot to talk about here, and since you made the film, there's been a lot of news breaking. Chevron has reviewed the film without seeing it and decided that it's short on facts.
Right. Long on emotion, short on facts.
But the other thing that is remarkable is that the judge in this case, Juan Nunez, has been subjected to a hidden camera entrapment scheme.
Yeah.
And Chevron pounced on that and said, look, he's biased. He's already made up his mind, and these people are trying to bribe him.
Yeah.
And it's as much of a setup as we've seen here domestically with this trumped-up scandal about Acorn.
Yeah.
And so this YouTube generation, I mean, I was kind of happy when Makaka got Senator Allen but it's gotten out of hand. So tell us a little bit about these two provocateurs who got a pencil camera. I guess they bought it on an airline in-flight magazine.
Right.
And decided to go undercover, and there's this grainy video that they have with Judge Nunez.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that are under or reported or not reported about this situation. First of all, even if you take it at its worst, and this judge is somehow implicated, which I don't believe he was taking a bribe, but I don't know for sure, obviously. But even if you say the worst case scenario, what is not being reported is that this is a new judge. Now, the judge who presided over the 2.5 years of field inspections, which were make up the bulk of the trial, which is the subject of my film Crude, where you see the incredible environmental toll and human health toll on the indigenous population.
Mm-hmm.
The judge who presided over all of those proceedings is not this judge. There is a new judge now on the case. It's also not the judge who received and oversaw the work of the independent court expert who determined that Chevron has a liability, recommended that, the judge find Chevron guilty to the tune of $27 billion. So there's a lot of misinformation about Judge Nunez.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually, the thing is people are lazy and they read the headlines, they report on the headlines, but they don't actually look at that videotape. And I urge people to look at that videotape because to me it just seems like really bad acting. And more importantly, at the very end of the tape, the judge is seen throughout this 20 minutes of video resisting any attempt to talk about any improprieties.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who's been involved in many language translation situations, if you look at it from that point of view, at the very end, this American businessman asks him a series of questions about the logistics of the case. And the very last question, as he's throwing on his jacket and the judge is trying to get out of the room because he says, I'm not going to talk about these things,
mm-hmm.
The American businessman says, and Chevron is the guilty party? And the judge says, yes. But to me, if you listen to that tape, it's a language translation issue after a series of questions. I believe the judge is simply saying the defendant in this case is Chevron, not that he's going to rule against them.
Mm-hmm.
So what has shocked me about covering this story for so long is the level of disinformation and spin. I don't know why it should shock me, but it does. the level of disinformation and incomplete information and spin that's put out about this case, I have a larger moral imperative, I guess, with this film. I mean, I'm not smart enough to figure out whether Chevron has wrapped itself up in enough legal arguments to actually prevail in a lawsuit in terms of the pure technical analysis of the law. To me, there's a larger issue at play, and that is the moral bankruptcy of all of this. You do not go into the homeland of people who have lived in harmony with nature, who have lived off the water for eons, who tread lightly upon the earth and completely despoil their environment, regardless of whether you have permission to do it, whether you have a legal release, all the things that they currently argue. I mean, it's just a moral bankruptcy, in my
mm-hmm.
opinion.
Well, I certainly understand that. Now, one more question about Judge Nunez, and just if you could, the South American countries have different legal structures. And I don't know in particular about Ecuador. I know Chile because I followed the investigation and trial of Pinochet. And there, the judge is a judge and prosecutor. And so I'm curious, what is the role of the judge in an Ecuadorian trial of this sort? Is it more traditional in line with an American structure, or is the judge also carrying the load of the prosecutor?
Well, the judge is not carrying the load of the prosecutor, but unlike an American civil case of this nature, the judge is the jury. There is no jury in this case, so the judge mm-hmm. is the one who makes the decision. There is no jury, but the judge is not playing the role of prosecutor. And one of the oddities in this case, and in this, cases involving environmental situations, they have a routine rotation of the judges. So every 2 to 2.5 years, the judge rotates off. That's why a new judge is now on the case.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's just mind-boggling that the judge who presided over the bulk of the trial actually then rotates off, and a new judge is going to make the decision. decision because, as you see in the movie Crude, you know, one of the last shots is, you know, walking through the back room where the, you know, where all the paperwork for this case is held, and you know, there have been hundreds of thousands of motions and pieces of paper filed in this case. It's mind-boggling. It'll take a judge another 2 years just to read all the findings, and you know, so it's an oddity in their system.
So the litigation's been underway for 16 years now. Chevron took over Texaco, about 2001?
Yeah, the companies merged in 2001, and Chevron inherited the liability.
And so this was not a secret. Chevron knew that in taking over Texaco, or call it a merger, whatever it is, Chevron was the dominant and surviving partner there. This did not come as any surprise, and in making this business transaction, Chevron knew that they were inheriting a significant exposure, at least potential liability, if not actual liability, for the mess that Texaco created.
Well, I would agree with that partially. I think, Texaco and Chevron, I mean, they fought for years to move this thing to Ecuador, and I don't think they ever believed it would actually be refiled. So I believe Chevron, you know, merged with Texaco in 2001 before the case was actually refiled in Ecuador. I think they thought this thing had been already swept under the rug. Mm. So I don't know if, technically speaking, they knew that there would be this massive liability awaiting them.
Okay.
But I do know that they spent a long time trying to push it into Ecuador, and of course now they're complaining that at the time they wanted it moved from the United States to Ecuador, they thought the courts there were fair and transparent. Now they're complaining that they're getting an unfair treatment because the case is not going their way.
And if you were to sum up the Chevron strategy, is this to gum it to death and run out the clock just because, they've got lawyers. In fact, Jim Haynes is his name. William, I think, is his given name, but he was the counsel at the Pentagon during the Rumsfeld era and signed a lot of the torture memos. He's now one of the chief counsels there at Chevron. Is their strategy just to delay and change venue and do everything they can just to tire out the parties and basically spend them into submission?
Well, again, I'm not privy to what their internal strategy discussions are, but it would seem to me that with their unlimited resources relative to the plaintiffs, and if you just actually do the math, to not pay if you take $27 billion, which is the purported judgment that everyone thinks is going to get handed down, and you're the most unsophisticated of investors and you just put $27 billion in the bank and get a CD off it, which obviously Chevron can do a lot more with $27 billion, just the interest alone on that money will buy many, many, many millions of dollars worth of the best law firms, PR firms, advertising agencies, crisis managers, and that is, in fact, what they have employed in this case. And I think, as you say, the strategy it would be, in my mind, to just keep this thing going until the plaintiffs give up. And, that's one of the larger theme of the film. I'm not necessarily taking sides in the lawsuit because I let each side have their say. Because for me, what I observed out of this mess is that I actually think the legal structures we have are inadequate for dealing with these large-scale environmental and humanitarian crises.
Yeah.
This is a struggle that has gone on for 17 years. We're probably only at the midway point. And because Chevron has no assets in Ecuador, it's going to also be difficult to make them pay. And yet we have three generations of people who are waiting for this verdict to be resolved, or the situation to be resolved, who will suffer. And it's unacceptable that these things take this long.
Joe, as you're saying that, I can't help but think of the Chevron advertising. They run spots on the public television news hour. They have these kind of happy talk radio spots with a pleasant announcer who talks earnestly about how Chevron now drills in a sensitive manner, how they spend $66 million a day exploring for new oil assets, and that they're committed to dealing with climate change, and that they want people to actually use less of their product. And they I call it greenwashing.
Yeah.
But they're using the huge profits that they've rolled up at our expense in the last couple of years to burnish an image as a company that's concerned about the planet, that's concerned about us as a nation and our future as we run out of fossil fuels and warm the planet, and it just grinds me.
Yeah.
Every time I hear those, and they've started running those spots on progressive radio stations,
yeah.
which causes real mixed feelings for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's an incredible irony to all of that, and the thing that I find very disturbing about this entire case is that, you have people down there who are suffering gravely. There is zero clean drinking water, which Chevron blames on bad sanitation. Which I think is an insult to those people who didn't have bad sanitation, before the arrival of Texaco. You would think that they would channel just some of the money they spend in advertising on simply making a humanitarian gesture. You know, one of the things the film profiles is Sting and his wife Trudy Styler, who have a Rainforest Foundation, came down to the region, were horrified at what they saw,
mm-hmm.
and for about $1 million they instituted a clean drinking water program using these rainwater filtration systems.
Right.
I'm sure the many law firms that work for Chevron on this case bill way in excess of $1 million on an annual basis. Why not take some of that money and do the smart PR thing and say, hey, you know what, we don't think we're responsible, but we profited from this country. Let us help while this thing gets, argued, instead of, putting these commercials out that give the false impression that they're actually caring humanitarians.
Mm-hmm. Joe, tell us about Pablo Fajardo. I really was inspired by your portrayal of him in Crude,
yeah.
and he picked up the Goldman Award here in San Francisco recently.
Yeah.
Talk about him and, how he developed his skills as an attorney and has essentially become, a critical figure in the future of the resolution of these issues.
Yeah, when Chevron moved this case to Ecuador, I don't think they were counting on a local hero phenomenon, which is exactly what's happened with Pablo. I mean, here is a guy who was an impoverished oil field worker who saw the humiliation of his co-workers and the environmental degradation around him and became so angry that he wanted to do something about it. He pulled himself up by the bootstraps, got himself educated, got a law degree, and found himself, and this is where the film begins, found himself as the lead attorney. Obviously, there's an American class action lawsuit behind him providing some funding, but the case would go nowhere without this kind of local populism. He finds himself as the lead attorney against, California's largest company, the fifth largest company in the world. It's a remarkable story. If it was a scripted fictional piece, you wouldn't believe it. And as the film observes him, he takes on this incredible arc of going from, toiling in obscurity against this oil company to some international prominence, culminating in the Goldman Environmental Prize. And one of the reasons I begin the movie with him winning the Environmental Prize in 2008 and then flashing back and telling the story of how we got there is I was stunned at the extreme disconnect between what Chevron says about Pablo and what I witnessed myself down in the region for 3 years. And basically, in fact, the smart thing for Chevron to have done when Pablo won the Goldman Environmental Prize, the smart thing would have been to say, hey, congratulations to Pablo. It's wonderful that he's committed to his people and is fighting this fight. We don't agree with him. We have a different view of the pollution. That would have been the smart thing. Instead, they went on San Francisco television station,
mm-hmm.
And ran full-page ads declaring that Pablo is an environmental con man who's pulled the wool over the media's eyes and is looking to line his pockets on the backs of Chevron.
It was despicable.
I mean, such an extreme position and so far from the truth. And that's, again, I'm not taking a position in the lawsuit per se, but, to call Pablo an environmental con man, it just, to me, was emblematic of the extreme disconnect about the spin, including these advertisements that you mentioned, the spin that's put out about this case and the disinformation versus what the reality on the ground is.
Mm-hmm. And tell me how Pablo felt about his portrayal in the film. Has he given you a review?
Well, you know, it was a very strange thing. We brought him to Sundance, the Sundance Film Festival, and you know, I think it's kind of, he kind of had the same reaction that he had when in the movie you see that you know, Stephen Donziger, the American consulting attorney, hands him a copy of Vanity Fair where he's gotten a profile. This is his first big media attention, was a 2007 profile in Vanity Fair in their Green issue. And he looks at the magazine, and he giggles a little bit embarrassingly, and then he quickly shifts to his observation that he's disappointed that there are only pictures of him in this article and not pictures of the sick people that he's represented, the people who are dying of cancer. And the same thing, you know, he came to Sundance. We had to get him, I actually had to give him my winter boots because he didn't have any winter boots. He was, you know, kind of flattered by all the attention, but, you know, for the most part, he's focused on, okay, how is this going to help the case? How is this going to, you know, move this thing forward? Although he did have a moment of relaxation, which is, I'm almost embarrassed to say, there was a moment where he, Sting, and Paris Hilton were actually having a little dance at the after party for Crude. It was one of those bizarre moments that can only happen at the Sundance Film Festival.
And, you know, I only have a tabloid view of Paris Hilton. is there any depth there? I mean, you know, you can play a bimbo.
you know, hey, she came to the movie. She said nice things about it, so I don't want to speak ill of anybody who says nice things about my work. How's that?
Joe, let's take a minute here because I think it's really important for our listeners to understand the true impact of Texaco's oil operations in the Ecuador Amazon basin there. And take a couple of minutes here, if you would,
yeah,
to describe some of the individuals and lives that have been lost, illnesses that are very clearly linked to this pollution. Give us a sense of the human toll.
Well, you know, I got kind of dragged into this film kicking and screaming. It wasn't necessarily a film I was looking to make. Stephen Donziger, the American attorney, came to my office. We have a mutual acquaintance. He told me about the pollution and the devastation. And, you know, it sounded horrifying, but it didn't seem like a film that I would necessarily want to make. It seemed like it was a 13-year struggle already in the making, and I like to film things in the present tense. I barely knew where Ecuador was. I wondered if anyone would care. I expressed all of these hesitations to him. You know, I also didn't want to make a kind of an agitprop film for a plaintiff's attorney. I'm a much more balanced, nuanced kind of filmmaker. So, you know, I expressed my hesitation to him, but he was convinced that if I only saw the pollution, that I would have a change of heart. And he was right. I went down to this region, and I was just dumbfounded. You know, this was my first trip to the Amazon, to the rainforest, and I was expecting, you know, some pollution, but I was also expecting to see a bit of a paradise. You know, the Ecuadorian Amazon is one of the few places on Earth that survived the last ice age, and therefore it has this tremendous biodiversity, species of plants and animals that have yet to be counted. And yet, the region I was in, which is a 1,700 square mile area the size of Rhode Island, just seemed like it was barely surviving 40 years of oil production, you know. And there are hundreds of unlined pits of petroleum waste that continue to leach into the water supply. You dig your shovel into any number of places, and you come up with, you know, oil-saturated dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Wells are polluted. I mean, there's a swath of this area there where there's literally no fresh drinking water. But the thing that kind of really whacked me over the head and made me decide that I had to shine a light on this somehow and try to help is that on the second day of my trip, my scouting mission, you know, I was taken by canoe to a Kofan village. You know, the Kofan are one of five indigenous tribes that are part of this lawsuit. And as I got out of the canoe and I was walking to a meeting, I noticed some village people preparing a communal meal by the river's edge. And instead of using freshly caught fish, they were using canned tuna from another part of the world,
mm-hmm,
because all the fish in the river were either dead or diseased. And that image, more than anything, you know, deep in the heart of the Amazon rainforest, with water-based people who have lived in harmony with nature for eons, being forced to eat canned tuna, which has its own level of pollution. You know, I didn't want to break it to them and say, hey, you know, this is not what you should be eating.
Yeah, you've imported mercury from the United States.
Exactly. You know, it just was shocking. And then you talk to mothers who just have this look of despair because they know that they're giving their children poisonous water. I mean, you know, we force these indigenous people into this quasi-Western lifestyle by virtue of the fact that we take away their traditional means of sustenance. They can no longer really care for themselves independently. That's why I say we kind of force them into this Western lifestyle. And then we abandon them without any economic resources, without health care infrastructure, with poisoned drinking water and a lack of food supply. And, you know, it's just shameful, particularly at a time in our history as humans, where we should be cherishing the knowledge of people who have tread lightly on the earth, who know how to live in harmony, instead of eradicating them as we have done over the centuries.
And the illnesses that are linked to the pollution include a cluster of cancers.
You know, look, there are claims and counterclaims, and Chevron has produced many studies to say that they're not linked. So, you know, officially speaking, you know, it's very difficult to prove causation. You can't say that oil caused this cancer from an official technical standpoint. So I can just tell you anecdotally, I saw 15 out of 20 babies with horrible skin rashes. I saw, you know, we profile in the movie a 34-year-old mother and an 18-year-old daughter, each of whom have cancer and make about $1,000 a year and have to take a 18-hour bus ride for their cancer treatments that cost $500 a pop. I saw just, you know, everyone I talked to had a young relative who died of cancer. So, you know, again, it's anecdotal. I am not a scientist, but it seemed like an awful lot of people were dying of cancer, and I saw an awful lot of skin rashes and skin lesions in that area, things that didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago.
And some of the scenes caused me to react in a way, not to criticize these indigenous people who are living, you know, in a traditional manner and the life that they know, but it's pretty clear that this is a deeply toxic and contaminated area. Why do they stay there, Joe? Why don't they relocate? Why doesn't the Ecuadorian government take them and resettle them in a place that isn't going to kill them?
That's easy for us to say in our mobile society and relative affluence, but where is an indigenous person going to go doesn't have two nickels to rub together? I mean, if you walk around a lot of these Latin American capitals, you know, there are, you know, homeless and deeply impoverished native people, you know, lying on the sidewalks. I mean, where do you send these people? They try to do the best they can in their ancestral homelands. The government is also, I agree, you know, not blameless in this situation. I mean, the government should do more, but they don't. You know, they don't have the resources. But I think it's kind of a very American, kind of very Western idea to say, well, you know, if you don't like San Francisco, move to Berkeley or move to New York. I mean, these are indigenous people with no resources. Where are they going to go?
Yeah. Well, Joe, you've made a powerful film, and I want people to see it.
Great.
Tell us how crude that our show is listened to all across the country. We do have a lot of listeners here in the Bay Area.
Oh, good. Well, we open in the Bay Area at the Lumiere and the Shattuck, and it may only be there for a week because that's the nature of these kinds of movies. So I urge people to get out. We open the 25th in the Bay Area, but we also are kind of slowly rolling across the country, so the best way to find out where the movie is playing and to support it would be at www.crudethemovie.com. You know, we're currently in New York at the IFC Center. We're in Los Angeles and Santa Monica at the, I think, the Lemley 4 or the Monica, I can't remember which, but you know, we're playing at, you know, the typical art house, one or two screens per city over the next few months.
Don't you wish Michael Moore would just wait a couple of weeks?
Yeah, you know, I love Michael, but, you know, he does tend to steal the thunder. But, hey, you know, I'm a different kind of a filmmaker, and this is a different kind of a story.
Indeed, yes. You're very different. Well, Joe, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I also want to direct people to AmazonWatch.org. That's a great organization that has been working on these issues and bringing them to the attention of Americans. And I think you should get steeped in the information. Also, at Amazon Watch, there's a link to the Gotcha movie or a little video that was taken of Judge Nunez, if you'd like to see that for yourself. Joe Berlinger, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to talk with
you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.